Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Latin American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Julian Dodson, your podcast host. Today, I'm delighted to be talking with my good friend and colleague, Dr. Joseph Linti. Dr. Linti is the author of Redeeming the Revolution, the State and Organized Labor in Post-Tlatelolco, Mexico, published by the University of Nebraska Press. He is Associate Professor of History at Eastern Washington University. Dr. Linti, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Julian.
Joe, I wonder if you could begin just by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. And again, thank you very much for inviting me. I've been a fan of NBN for a while, and this is quite an honor.
Awesome.
I'm originally from Massachusetts, a town called Southbridge. And I grew up in a community that was very, very ethnically diverse. I myself am the product of Italian migration. The community has a long history of immigration from Eastern, Western Europe, Asia, and increasingly so Latin America. The town I grew up in had quite a large Puerto Rican population, which, you know, unbeknownst to me at the time, has absolutely impacted my life and my interests and my career. I went to college, I studied history. I had an interest at that time in the American Revolution, Massachusetts, Boston being the sort of context for that. But I became increasingly interested in Latin America simply through a trip to Mexico, but more and more appreciating the kind of community and the origins that I experienced in the Latino community in my hometown. While in college, I read a book by someone who would be my future graduate advisor, Dr. Linda Hall, who you know very well. I read her book, Oil Banks and Politics, which is a fairly, you know, straightforward history of the Mexican Revolution and the role of finances and oil in the post-revolutionary construction of the state. But that really sent me off on a track that ultimately brought me to New Mexico to study with Dr. Hall, and it really shaped my research interests in modern Mexico, and specifically the concept of the Mexican Revolution, and the kind of state that event would ultimately form. So I truly enjoyed and loved my experiences at the University of New Mexico studying Latin American history, my travels to Mexico over the years, and those factors absolutely shaped my career and my research interests, and even a bit of who I am personally.
Right, and I should mention that Joe and I, as he alluded to, share an academic advisor, Dr. Linda Hall, and Linda, if you're listening, we love you very much. And Joe and I both studied at the University of New Mexico. Our time overlapped there. And like a lot of us, it's really kind of difficult, right, to travel to Mexico and not fall in love, and as in my interest in Mexico kind of came to me in a very similar way. So Joe, you've got this this whole discursive bit in your introduction on the concept of redemption, right? It's in the title, you know, what it is to redeem And in the Mexican context, I wonder if you could elaborate a little bit on the conceptual framing around the title and the central theme of the book.
Sure. I think it's easy to romanticize Mexican politics and history through a religious framework, a religious lens. You know, I think some of the things that brought me into the study of Latin America was my Catholic upbringing. You know, again, to kind of connect this to my own kind of origin story. As an Italian Catholic, I was looking for kind of religious symbols in Mexico that had some kind of connection to my own life. And this is dangerous because this can cause you to internalize and conceptualize a completely, you know, foreign and a completely different setting through a very personalized lens, which can lead to some, you know, false conclusions. Nevertheless, the story of the Mexican Revolution, despite the fact that the Mexican Revolution is, you know, it was a political, a military, a political, and ultimately state formation movement that had distinct anti-clerical ends, right? That was one of the primary tenets of the revolution, was this kind of effort to reduce the presence and certainly the economic and political power of the Catholic Church in Mexico. Nevertheless, the Catholic superstructure is always there to influence the words, the thoughts, the actions of the great majority of the Mexican people. And in particular, you know, working class, largely conservative Mexican peoples who form themselves into unions. So the idea of redemption comes very distinctly from the early Christian story of the redeemers, those who would have purchased Christian captives or Christian slaves from outsiders who had gone to battle with the Roman Empire and taken them as captives. So redemption literally means to purchase the life and ultimately guarantee the salvation of a Christian who is held hostage by a non-Christian. And this comes from, you know, 3rd, 4th century Syria and the Romans, in the early Christians' dealings with the Saracens. So this was not a concept that I went into this project, you know, imagining would become central to it. Yet at every turn, the rhetoric of unionists, specifically the rhetoric of President Luis Echeverria, is just laden with all kinds of Catholic imagery that harkens back to this notion of salvation. The Mexican government, as led by Echeverria, sees itself as an institution that will save the people from this sort of pre-revolutionary state of anarchy, poverty, you know, inefficiency, imperialism, all these kind of typical rhetorical tools that are now cast to the people with religious iconography or imagery. So the idea of a redeemer is something which is very, very common in the story of Latin American and specifically Mexican politics. The great Mexican historian Enrique Krause wrote a book called Redeemers, and he points to a number of political figures who overtly or not identify themselves as redeemers. And his book focuses on people like Simón Bolívar, intellectuals like Octavio Paz. Interestingly, though, he doesn't mention Echeverria, who I call a redeemer. But according to Krause, who has a very personal connection to Mexico, of course, 1968, Echeverria, he doesn't ascribe Echeverria that title in a way which I think is interesting. But I think through the words and actions of Luis Echeverria, others in Mexico, importantly, Jesús Reyes Heroles, president of the party during the period I study, there is very clear kind of redemptionist tactics and certainly redemptionist rhetoric being used.
Right. And, you know, I think it's probably important, you know, at this point for our readers who maybe don't have like a complete picture of, you know, what the revolution was, right? What it signified, you know, between 1910, 1920, 1920, 1930. But then after, right, it kind of takes on a meaning that is often shaped by, you know, sort of state civil society dialogues in a lot of ways. And what I was really interested in is that you kind of go way back, right, with this idea of redemption and kind of filling out how it applies, right, to this particular moment that's set off by 1968, right? Can you talk a little about, just offer a little bit of the context there, so our listeners kind of get a sense of exactly what you're talking about redemption in the context of the Mexican Revolution?
Sure, thank you. Yeah, let me just say, Julian, it's a pleasure to be speaking about this with someone who's as knowledgeable about modern Mexico as you are. I look forward to it.
Right. Well, you know us Mexicanists that do the revolution, we are, you know, neck deep in the minutia.
Yes, sure, right. So yes, although I don't need to explain, give the kind of historical overview to you, certainly there are some out there who I would like to read the book, and, you know, students of ours who need a little bit more background than we might. The 1968 is the fulcrum, I think, upon which modern Mexican history really begins. The events that occurred, the student movement that begins quite a few years before that, but ultimately that culminates in 1968, does produce pressure on the state unlike anything seen in Mexico since the time of the revolution. And certainly what happens on October 2, the evening of October 2, October 3, 1968, through a massacre of hundreds of people at Tlatelolco, puts pressure on the Mexican government in a way that it had not experienced in the post-revolutionary period. So these very, very significant challenges to the authority and thus the legitimacy of the Mexican government forces politicians to reestablish rhetorically, and eventually, through legislation, it forces them to reestablish why the Mexican government, as a product of the revolution, is justified to lead the nation. And I think what I established early on, specifically in this very long introduction in chapter one, is how the institution Mexico had never been, prior to the revolution, this sort of all-consuming organism that had a significant impact on people's lives. After 1920, certainly after 1928, that changes. And the Mexican state does become a state in the context that we understand it from a, you know, developed world perspective. So 1968 challenges the authority of the government and requires it to take action to restore its legitimacy and thus perpetuate its rule.
So in that context, right, the concept of redemption that you lay out there becomes really important, because it is in this labor law, the 1970 labor law that you kind of focus on, where, you know, the Echeverria administration attempts to say, you know, to organize labor, we are the bearers of the revolution. We are still relevant to the revolution, and as you say, you know, they claim that legitimate revolutionary position. Am I right there?
Yes, absolutely.
So I want to maybe shift a little bit and ask you a question about archives, about methodologies that you're employing. What's kind of the your approach to your sources? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure, thank you. The research for this specific project. Well, let me recast that. I've been going to Mexico to do archival work in earnest since about 2004. Really, 2005 was my first major research project when I researched for my master's thesis. And doing archival work in Mexico in 2004, 2005 is quite different than it is today. I mean, then you know, 2005 when I began really delving into the General Archive of the Nation, the AGN, in 2006 and 7, there were no digital finding aids. You know, there are guías or catalogs that tell you basically the names of collections, but that's about as detailed as it gets at that time. So my first experiences were going to certain galleries in the AGN and other institutions, speaking to an archivist, usually a wonderful man or a woman who knew history, who knew that had a, you know, an expert, a masterful connection with the resources, and would then go to the stacks, come back a little bit later with boxes that presumably could help me do my work. So this is not a targeted research trip by any means. This is sort of a scattershot approach to understanding a research question. And we would have these very, very, you know, long, detailed discussions about exactly what I want to do. And the archivist would make decisions based on what I said, you know, where some of the most interesting case studies of, say, worker-employer conflict occurred. If she believed or if he believed that it was in Monterrey, that's where my sources would come from. If she believed it was in San Luis Potosí, that's where my sources would come from. So my first kind of dalliance in Mexican archives was an incredibly personal and beautiful experience, but very inefficient by the standards of modern archival science. You know, I often tell my students who are students at a regional comprehensive university in Eastern Washington, they have access to the state's Eastern Washington regional branch of the state archive. They also have access to the digital archive online, which anyone on earth can access. And I often tell them that research for them is simply unfair. They can do things that many of us who research in the developing world simply can't do, with a level of efficiency which is almost impossible, even to this day in Mexico. And let me say one thing before I forget. This changed quite a bit in Mexico, largely through the efforts of an army of students at the National University, UNAM, and students led by a Latin Americanist some of us know very well. Her name is Dr. Linda Arnold, and she's a history professor at Virginia Tech. I don't know if you know her, Julian.
I do. And sure. And this is a really important point that the AGN has come a long way, and Dr. Arnold has done so much work to make that archive legible for scholars. And mm-hmm. and absolutely a shout out to Dr. Linda Arnold is in order.
Yes. Absolutely. And I met her on my first days at the AGN. We chatted a little bit. I told her about my project. She gave me some excellent tips on, you know, what kind of collections to look at. But the digital finding aid that she produced is a magnum opus. It's a lifetime's work of someone who spent years, I'm not even sure how many years, many, many years in that archive, simply going through the connections and doing the you know, thankless tasks of cataloging these things and ultimately putting them online for researchers to use. So the AGN, I have immense, you know, fondness for. I love that place. It's come so far simply since I've been working there, beginning in about 2005.
And do you, when you were in the archive, and in a lot of cases, you know, we, in the early stages, right, we kind of know what we're looking for, but we don't really. And the help of the archivists, and, you know, and especially as you mentioned, that army of students from UNAM that have worked as diligently to catalog and to, again, make that archive legible. I wonder if you, in the course of your research, found, you know, any juicy stories from the documents in the archives that you'd like to share.
Absolutely. The majority of my work, probably two-thirds, maybe even more, was done in the National Archive. It was done in Gallery 2, which is, you know, colloquially referred to as the Spy Archive. Here you have the declassified papers of the General Directorate of Political and Social Investigations, or the DGIPS, which was one of these parallel bureaucracies. It was one of the two intelligence bureaucracies operating in Mexico in the 60s and 70s during the period I review. And here you basically read the reports of moles, men mostly, who had infiltrated union meetings, infiltrated student meetings. And they describe who's there. They describe the kinds of placards and banners that they're hoisting. And they give just a little bit of a commentary on what's going on, you know, how much of a threat this might be to the Mexican state. So hundreds of these accounts are absolutely essential. The accounts of spies, basically, you know, government agents who are infiltrating these groups that are deemed, that they deem subversive. You know, we would typically deem them simply, you know, political organizations. But in the context of 1960s and 70s Mexico, specifically in the context of the Cold War, these groups that are advocating position counter to that of the revolution state are deemed subversive, communist, of course. And there's this story after story that are, you know, fantastically interesting about the actions of these groups and in the way that the state sees them as this existential threat to the stability of the Mexican government.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Right. And what's interesting, Joe, is you know, the Cold War in Mexico clearly plays out much differently than in, you know, for example, Brazil, Argentina, Chile, and the rest of Latin America. There are, you know, very specific reasons why, of course, you know, Mexico has sort of this sort of soft dictatorship, you know, the dictatorship of the PRI for so long kind of exhibits or kind of displays a kind of, you know, electoral democracy that that kind of masks a soft dictatorship, right? And of course, you know, there is, you know, dirty war that mars that particular period in Mexico, but not in the same way that you know, the Argentine junta is marred by dirty war, or, you know, the regime of Augusto Pinochet in Chile, for example. How do you see that? Is that kind of your experience? Do you have any kind of thoughts on the key differences between Mexico and the Cold War and the rest of Latin America?
Oh, the differences are profound. Yet there is, unfortunately, a unifying thread. The difference is that the revolution as a metonym that stands in for the government, I believe, and I argue this in the book, requires the government to constantly contend and ascertain its connection to the working classes of Mexico, the peasants and the workers. And to a lesser extent, you know, low paid, but white collar professionals at a sort of lower level, at an employee status, I should say. So because the revolution has this overt working class solidarity, the Mexican government must always advocate for the positions of the people, of the masses. And that means that it can't be this overt, it can't have this overt alliance with these oligarchic actors, like the landowners, like the large company owners, like the church, for that matter. So the Mexican Revolution requires the government to be populist, and presidents, to a greater or lesser extent, after 1924, take on that identity. Luis Echeverria and his successor, José López Portillo, are overt national populists. Everything they say, basically, is how they're defending the ideals of the revolution, the ideals of Zapata, the ideals of Madero, the ideals of Carranza, even. Still, where this contrast is that, of course, this contrasts with military dictatorships that come to power in places like Argentina, in places like Chile, in Central American republics like Nicaragua, Guatemala. Nevertheless, there is a dirty war being waged. It's smaller in scope, but scholars have proven that it's as vicious. A great book by historian Alexander Avinia looks at how the dirty war waged by Echeverria in Guerrero in the 1970s, how brutal it was, and the extent of, we're not just talking a few isolated cases of kidnappings and murders, we're talking about hundreds being killed, tortured, executed, sometimes having their bodies dumped in the Pacific from helicopters. So here you get a case study of how the rhetoric of the revolution absolutely juxtaposes the reality of this Cold War state that is intent upon preserving security and stability, all the while it shrouds itself in this rhetoric of working class populism and social justice. There's not a whole lot of talk about social justice in Pinochet's Chile, but in Mexico, that is the airwaves and the newspapers are absolutely saturated with that kind of
thing. Right, and again, we're back to the revolution, the importance of the revolution in the 20th century.
Yes.
Right, it extends beyond the Cold War, right?
Yes.
I wanted to ask you a question about challenges. You talked a little bit about, very early in the research, challenges with sort of finding what it is you were looking for in the archives. But on a broader scale, I wonder if you could talk to any challenges, either in the research or the writing of the book that were significant.
Challenges, yes. It was difficult, and for a lot of academics who begin a major research project, the sources, as I mentioned, my research method was pretty scattershot in the beginning before I really had a sense of what exactly I was looking for. And I scoured hundreds, maybe thousands of case studies that were all useful, but not in a kind of systematic or a refined way. But ultimately, I think access, this project, because it was relatively recent. Like I said, I began the research process in 2007, specifically for this project. And at this point, you're 40 years removed from Tlatelolco, more or less. And there's people around that I can speak to. But as a graduate student, I don't have a lot of access. I don't have a lot of clout. I do have to recognize my privilege as a North American white male. You do have access to people that others, including Mexican students, don't have. And that's something I think that I've been able to, unfortunately, enjoy even more so in subsequent years due to my, once you have a doctorate in Mexico, doors open. You can speak to politicians. You can speak to certainly academics at all levels. And again, being a North American and being a male allows you to have access that typical Mexican students and researchers don't have. But in the beginning, I didn't have any of that access. I wanted to conduct oral histories, but I had very little access to union officials, certainly government officials who could have conceivably told me about firsthand experiences from this time. So initially, my access was fairly limited, although that's changed in recent years.
So you make the argument, and this is a good way to kind of get into your assessment of the Echeverria period. You make the argument that Echeverria, and I'm going to quote just a bit, that, quote, most closely followed the salvation matrix, kind of in reference to what we were talking about earlier, this concept of redemption. And he's been, you alluded to this in the context of the Dirty War in Mexico, he's been a rather vilified figure in Mexican history for his role in the massacre at Tlatelolco, or he wasn't president at the time, and also in the context of the Dirty War. In the context of post-Tlatelolco labor relations, how does he fit in there? Can you talk a little bit about how he fits into that, as you say, salvation matrix?
Good question. That's absolutely central to the book. My thesis, which is certainly the most controversial aspect of the book, is that after Tlatelolco, Echeverria, Secretary of the Interior during the massacre of Tlatelolco, he is the one who is running. He's running the day-to-day campaign of the Mexican state to counter the student movement. He's the one dealing directly, for example, with the National Strike Committee. And he's the one ordering the army and later these sort of paramilitary units to counter students and, in the case of the massacre of Tlatelolco, kill them. So he's vilified, and with good reason. He absolutely was the one who sort of, you know, pulled the trigger, pardon the pun, it's a terrible pun in this context, on the use of the Olympic Battalion against the students on October 2 and 3, 1968. So he's never going to be forgiven by the Mexican left or anyone who has any sympathy with any kind of, you know, political activism in Mexico. But in terms of his relationship to the working class, that's a different story. I mean, there's been a lot of great literature written by those who took part in 68. People like, for example, Elena Poniatowska, Gladys Hernandez, Paco Ignacio Taibo. These were men and women who took part in 68. They took part in the demonstrations. They occupied campuses. But they also spoke to factory workers because they believed that their cause had salience to blue-collar Mexican workers. And at least in the case of Paco Ignacio Taibo, he pointed out how most factory workers supported the cause of the students. You know, they might have harbored some class resentment. This is an age-old reality. Workers and students in a country like Mexico, where despite the fact university education is free, it's still exclusive only to those in the middle classes, because of course you have to, if you're in school studying, you can't work, right? There's an opportunity cost involved in going to college, which means that most working class people can't go to college, in addition to very, very difficult entrance exams, which keep the children of the working class out of university. Nevertheless, according to scholars who participated in 68, most workers supported the cause of the students. That is not evident in the writings of the official organs of the major unions, like the CTM. The Confederation of Mexican Workers, which is the primary actor in my book, expresses nothing but anger, resentment, and even hatred toward Mexican students. It constantly casts them as privileged, petulant, meaning that they're childish, that they don't know anything about the real world, that they're effeminate. That's a pejorative that comes up a lot. You know, they wear long hair, they have fancy clothes, they listen to strange exotic music. In essence, they're not real men. And in essence, they're not real Mexicans. So the official position of the unions and in the periodicals that they produce is that the students and Mexican workers have nothing in common. And therefore, simply by reading the editions of CTM, the weekly magazine of the CTM, you would think that there's absolutely no commonality in the cause and in some of the struggles of Mexican workers and students. So again, rhetorically, in the pages of these union periodicals, Echeverria is, he's a savior. He defends and promotes the interests of the Mexican worker at the great expense of the privileged, petulant, imperialistic classes of the Mexican elite, those who send their children to fancy universities to get educations instead of working to build a country. So they have a healthy reverence for him.
And that's kind of interesting, because it is sort of like a major intervention that you're making there, that the major, right, the national body, the CTM, it didn't support, if you had certain workers organizations, certain unions that did support the students. It was the larger national body that supported Echeverria. Which is kind of an interesting thing to think about. And I think, as you say, does kind of put him into this mold, as salvation, or into the salvation matrix, as you say. I understand you met Echeverria. Can you talk a little bit about that experience?
I did. And this really reinforces what I said a bit earlier about how, we live in the United States, we live in a credential society. Mexico is an even more clear-cut credential society. With credentials, with degrees, and with a professional reputation, you can do things that regular people can't. And what I mean by that is that all of a sudden doors are open. I can now talk to union heads. I can now talk to, I can walk inside the headquarters of the PRI on Avenida Insurgentes and get an interview with maybe the party president if he's available. I can speak to academics at the highest level simply through my credentials. And this meant that when this book was published, I do have connections in Mexico, people who are very, very high up in politics and in academia. We were very interested in this book, and it was published almost 2017 is nearly the 50th anniversary of Tlatelolco, so there was some coincidence, an important milestone there. So I presented the book at UNAM, which I consider, the highlight of my career. It probably always will be. This is the bastion of the Mexican student movement. It's one of the finest universities in the world, and there were people who were very interested who had connections to politics that basically opened doors for me to meet the former president. So the day after I presented that, I was escorted to his home, and I met with him and his daughter. And this is not an interview by any chance. Let me give you a little bit of the backdrop here, because at the time Echeverria was 95. He's been living in a state of self-imposed exile basically since 2007. In 2007, the Mexican Supreme Court had basically ruled that the statute of limitations had expired on any purported crimes against humanity, war crimes that he might have committed while president. And they were looking at some of these allegations of murder that he carried out as president against guerrilleros in the mountains of Guerrero, against the students at Tlatelolco. But again, to make a long story short, they ruled that the statute of limitations had expired and that he could not be tried for these war crimes. Since then, however, Echeverria has basically been shut in at his home in Mexico City, and he hasn't been seen in the public eye. So it was quite remarkable to be able to go into his home and meet him and discuss this book. I delivered him a couple copies of the book. I signed them in a way that's, I consider, academically honest. I wrote in the inscription, I wrote, "To a true redeemer of the principles of the Mexican Revolution," which might be shocking initially, but I think what I meant by that was that he promoted ideals of the revolution that were rhetorically accurate. He did promote workers' rights. one of the central tenets of the revolution. Through the promulgation of the new federal labor law of 1970. And again, the book highlights all the ways that his government did succeed to create institutions like Infonavit, the housing institute, how it did pass several minimum wage increases. He also promoted other rhetorical aspects of the revolution. The new agrarian law of 1971 dealt specifically with the issue of land reform and land invasion in Mexico. So rhetorically, he was an arch defender of the revolution. And that's what I wanted to convey in that inscription. But meeting him also allowed me to sort of test some of my conclusions about him. And he is the most important individual in the book. Echeverria cast himself as a true Mexican, meaning he had a very overt anti-imperial message. Famously, he did things like at state dinners, he replaced whiskey and bourbon with agua de horchata, tequila, other kind of locally produced Mexican drinks. He always wore the guayabera, the formal shirt of the kind of Caribbean gentleman. He and his wife, Doña Maria Esther, the first lady, they constantly appeared in public dancing traditional Mexican bailes. He liked to tell the press that he was like most Mexicans who spoke one language, Spanish. So he cast himself as a true man of the people Cárdenas did, of course, 40 years earlier, but with less sincerity. Cárdenas was, by all accounts, but from the perspective of his ethnic origin, from the perspective of his class, from the perspective of his tastes, his mannerisms, he was a regular Mexican man. Echeverría absolutely came from this, what the historian Daniel Cosío Villegas called the chemically pure political class of Mexico City. So he had to work very hard to appear a man of the people. So being in his home, it was interesting, if nothing else, to see paintings of the Virgin of Guadalupe on every wall. He had a home which absolutely fit into this, it had this aesthetic congruence with the Echeverría that he tried to depict himself as president in the 1970s.
Well, what you're describing there is certainly a populist political persona that maybe had to work a little bit harder than Cárdenas did, certainly, but still he wasn't that far from that image, if I understand what you're saying.
Yes and no. I guess with any life, you can find as many contradictions as you can find congruences. One thing I noticed about Echeverría, when I delivered him the book, I handed it to his daughter, who, as I mentioned in the book, she's a spitting image of her mother, and her mother is almost deified at the house. Her picture is everywhere. She was she, in contrast to her husband, is beloved by the Mexican people. And when I mentioned to my Mexican friends I was working on a book that focused on President Echeverría, almost immediately they talked about Doña Maria Esther, the First Lady, because she was as famous and certainly more admired by the Mexican people. And the house is almost a museum to her. When I handed Echeverría's daughter the book, she was grateful, and she told me how her father reads everything. He reads newspapers from all over the world, and how he will read the book immediately. And I instantly remembered writing in my book about how Echeverría constantly said, even boasted about the fact that he was monolingual, that he only spoke Spanish. So I thought that was kind of an interesting kind of curiosity there, the fact that maybe he did speak multiple languages. But as a populist leader, the goal was to tell the people how much like them he was, and that he was just an ordinary guy, spoke Spanish, revered the Virgin of Guadalupe, and dressed like them, looked like them, prayed like them. So I wonder how much of that was simply political theory.
Right. Well, it's a good, I think a good way to kind of get into the next question that I had. Echeverria kind of seems like the one of the last, maybe with the exception of López Portillo, kind of the last of these. Well, okay, so you use two terms, politico and técnico, in the book, in the epilogue. Your book is great. It has as a conclusion that kind of wraps up your discussion of the post-Tlatelolco period. But then you look a little bit forward into kind of the decade of the 80s and the 90s, where you see a kind of a massive change in political culture in this period. And that era of the Luis Echeverria kind of dwindles. It kind of fades away. Talk a little bit about those changes that you see in the 80s and the 90s as Mexico moves fully into a neoliberal era.
Yes. Yeah. You're right. The book really focuses on the presidency of Echeverria and to a lesser extent, López Portillo, who I call the last revolutionary populists or the last revolutionary nationalists to hold the presidency in Mexico. In some ways, their legacy is shaped by what succeeded them. The rise of the técnicos, right? The rise of these foreign educated Mexican politicians who, instead of studying law at UNAM, like most Mexican presidents did prior to them, they study business or they study finance or they even study things like, you know, community planning or urban planning in foreign institutions, specifically places like Harvard, Princeton, the University of Chicago. And this extends to the governors and mayors even, not just presidents in Mexico. So the técnicos, they move farther and farther away from the actual events of the revolution. You know, Echeverria's father was an important revolutionary general. So he had that, he was steeped in revolutionary rhetoric and tradition. So we're moving away from this, you know, pivotal event, this, you know, crucible of the modern Mexican state. And we're moving into a time when leaders they feel more comfortable allowing foreign ideals to influence their minds and thinkings. Técnicos consider themselves experts who are proficient in, you know, governance, in contrast to the politicos, who they see as hacks or just, you know, ideologues or you know, charismatic individuals with very little command of governing. And with the rise of someone like Carlos Salinas, it becomes almost common to idealize the efforts of someone like Echeverria and even López Portillo. There's very little to praise about his presidency and his actions. If Echeverria was steeped in contradiction and, you know, crass populism, López Portillo took that to an unimaginable level. So I believe that the legacies of someone like Echeverria improve with the rise of the técnicos, because there are Mexicans who believe that their country has been seized by these outsiders, Mexicans with foreign ideals, Mexicans with foreign connections. And they almost long for the time of the supremacy of the revolution state metonym, which absolutely disappears beginning in 1982.
So I just want to thank you again. This has really been a great interview. We've taken a lot of your time, but in the moments that we have left, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about what you're working on now.
Sure. I'm not straying too far afield from this project, in that I'm looking at a sort of third tenet of the revolution, land reform. You know, I feel like I covered the workers' rights aspect. Now I want to move into land reform, because I believe that this is the sort of primary story of the Mexican Revolution. The need to distribute land to the disentailed masses of Mexico, people who have lost their land through a century of manipulation, the rise of the haciendas, for example. So land reform instituted with the Constitution of 1917 ultimately distributes land, yes, but it doesn't create a sustainable rural lifestyle. In fact, the goals of it might have been flawed from the get-go. Mexico, like a lot of Latin American nations, experiences massive internal migration and ultimately urbanization in the 20th century. So a lot of these people from the defunct ejidos and ranches that fail move into the cities and turn Mexico into a country which is today 90% urban. So my next project is looking at internal migration, hyper-urbanization, and how Mexican squatters are essentially integrated and even co-opted into the modern state. So what I do is I look at the rise of shantytowns, and I look at how these people interact with the government and the power that they exert vis-a-vis the Mexican state.
That sounds like fascinating research, Joe. Can't wait to read it. Right. again, we've been talking to Dr. Joseph Linty, the author of Redeeming the Revolution, the State and Organized Labor in Post-Tlatelolco Mexico. I want to thank you, Joe, for talking with me today. I really enjoyed it. Thanks, everybody, for listening.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
Thanks, everybody, for listening to the New Books in Latin American Studies podcast. I'm Julian Dodson. Until next time.